Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is April 1st, April Fool's Day, 2026. And this is episode 594. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, coming to you from the Erie Canal in Western New York State. You are listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd, one word, and support the show and get all the episodes and stuff, other stuff. I'm on the line, of course, with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Southern Italia. John, how you doing?
I'm fine, but I mean, about the Erie Canal, I think...
Yeah,
I just
thanks for the books, by the way.
Yeah,
that was cool.
Yeah, I just thought of a way to solve your backyard tick problem. You get a mule and you name her Sal, and then you just sort of make the mule go around the backyard, and you vacuum up her legs, and eventually you get all the ticks.
Yeah, except they multiply, and by the time we, you know, the mule, the live Velcro kind of hoovers up all those ticks, the mule might get pretty skinny.
Yeah.
After a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. Ticks are just, man, do they? My wife has a great idea, which is get chickens.
Chickens. Yeah.
And it's a question about whether we're allowed to have chickens in our backyard. But there's two problems with chickens. Chickens would take care of the ticks. But we got foxes and coyotes in the area, not to mention fisher cats and the rest. And yeah. I'm not sure how those chickens would fare. And on top of it, man, we are so animaled out. I love animals, but, you know, we have three parrots, three cats, a bunch of saltwater fish, and a dog. And I got to tell you, the hardest ones by far are the parrots. The birds right. require a lot of... Man, they're divas. They require a lot of attention.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not shy like dogs and even cats. When they want something, they let you know. I mean, with the beak to a sensitive part of your face. So,
And they want attention. My brother and I spent a lot of time scratching the back of the cockatiel's neck. I mean, it loved that, and it didn't want to hear any excuses.
Yeah, I know. You stop, you die. Keep going. Yeah, I know. Okay, so let's get to our show today. We have a great episode with friend of the show, returning guest, Peter Karataev of the excellent, supremely great Substack Events in Ukraine, my favorite Substack newsletter. It's always just, always grotesque, honest, funny, brutal, and true. And so it has all the great ingredients. So first of all, Peter, thanks for coming back on to Radio Warnerd.
Thanks, Luke. Guys, have me on.
So today we are going to talk about the Ukraine war. And I guess the first question is, who even remembers the Ukraine war anymore? I mean, one of the first things I wondered, and you know, you kind of told, I was just wondering how the Ukraine war has taken a hit in the attention, in the all-important attention economy, first because Trump decided he didn't care anymore. Of course, in Europe, it's still, I think, if not the number one, at least among European elites and media, it's very high up there. But in the U.S., even though kind of the elites, certainly the center-left elites, hate Trump, they always tend to follow wherever the president, the not king, you know, kind of his attention goes. And so it's no longer on the front pages as much, but it's trying to keep getting there. Have you noticed a drop off in attention too? I know you're not in the U.S., but from where you are.
Yeah, man, it's not good. We need to, it's not great. Yeah. We need to lobby, I think, Trump to end this war in the interests of Ukraine Substackers, I think. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, obviously, I think the attention on Ukraine has been off for a long time, mm-hmm. obviously, in the U.S. In Europe as well, I think. I mean, I was mm-hmm. in Europe not long ago, and, you know, talk with people, and most people don't really really care, which is kind of, I mean, fair enough. I mean, speaking of Europe as well, I mean, there's this whole endless saga with the credit, the $90 billion credit.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. Yeah, the $90 billion. What's the latest on that?
I mean, there was a statement yesterday by Kaya Kallas where she mm-hmm. said that basically she doesn't know when or even if the 90 billion euros are ever going to get through. And it was interesting because there was a bit less of the emphasis on Hungary and Slovakia as being the issues at fault. And it seemed like a bit of a more general. And I mean, you can see how obviously the inflation is going to even further make it, you know, general economic problems because of Iran are going to make it even less, I guess, make the Eurocrats less willing to get this through. I've always sort of had the feeling like they're sort of blaming the Hungarians and the Slovakians for vetoing this credit, when in reality, there's definitely serious sections of the European, it's like general Brussels elite or whatever, that just don't want to, maybe one of the off-ramp from the Ukraine war, maybe want Russian energy to come back and so on. Ukraine still hasn't received this 90 billion euros, which is its main financial support at this point. The Ukrainian government's talking about a financial crisis, a catastrophe, they said, mm-hmm. that should erupt by around summer. Zelensky said yesterday as well they won't be able to prepare for winter and so on. Anyway, I mean, it's very politicized as well in Ukraine, the discussion of the causes of all this and in terms of domestic politics in a way that's just too complicated. But definitely, it's not good, though, for sure.
I noticed today the New York Times is featuring multiple articles about how Ukraine can contribute to the American war with Iran, because Ukraine is building such third-generation drones and other battle tech. And it seemed like, okay, we got this new war. We're a slavish media. We got to follow the president. But we also want to drag the last cause in there. So we're going to pull Ukraine into it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole drone, because I mean, the main claim they have is that the Ukrainian drone interceptors or intercepted drones that basically mm-hmm. hunt down other drones are this really incredible solution for the Iranian Shahed drones and so on. I mean, it's pretty interesting looking at the media coverage of this. Zelensky was obviously talking about this since about the beginning of the Iran war. But if you look at the, especially the New York Times played a major role in this, and throughout the beginning of March, they were putting out these articles claiming, at first, you know, the claim was that both America, both Washington and the Middle Eastern, you know, Arab states were requesting Ukrainian help. And generally the sources for these in the New York Times articles were the Ukrainian drone manufacturers themselves. and then there would always be this sort of element where the Arab countries would then either refuse to comment or they denied this. And then obviously Trump himself, you know, he said, "There's nothing we need less than Ukrainian drones." But I mean, I was looking as well at some of the original, Zelensky originally had this quite, I forgot about this, but Zelensky's original claim or like proposal was that by giving the Arabs, the Gulf Arabs, our wonderful drones, they will be able to pressure Russia and get Russia to agree to a ceasefire, a month-long ceasefire, whatever, which is a interesting idea. Because apparently, you know, since the UAE and Saudi Arabia are so close to Russia, they'll somehow pressure Russia into accepting this, which obviously Russia doesn't want a temporary ceasefire deal. They want a long-term peace and so on. That's their...
I would also add, if you remember in the summer of 2024 when Qatar, I think it was Qatar and the Saudis maybe, or one of them, were brokering a kind of an energy ceasefire because both sides were kind of hammering each other's energy infrastructure. And they were having kind of, outside of whatever Trump got going, it was really kind of the best talks that they had going since early 2022. And Zelensky just used that as cover for his Kursk incursion. Do you remember that? So, like, I really wonder. I mean, Zelensky's just, I guess he just says whatever he wants to believe, like a lot of these people.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely not going to be a temporary ceasefire.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. That's but I mean, sure. What is, oh yeah, but I mean, then with the intercepted drones themselves, I mean, there are, obviously, I mean, Ukraine has been really focusing on this the past year or so. And it's become a little bit obsession is the wrong term, but I mean, they never really shut up about these intercepted drones. They really love the names of them as well, like the they're called like Pee-Pee and Dildo and all these things. I mean, yeah. It's
the Pasoon, right? I thought Pasoon means, it's like a kid. Children's term for penis, is that right?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
So, like, I don't know, Willy or PP or whatever you want, whatever floats your boat. But I mean, obviously, the whole issue is that in Ukraine itself, there are serious, let's say, insufficiencies when it comes to air defense. There was an interesting statement by the head of the army in Ukraine about how there were 6,000 intercepted drone sorties in February, and they took down 1,000 Russian drones. But then, I mean, the thing is that Russia launches several thousand drones each month. So, I mean, obviously, there's like, you know, they're not getting all of the drones with these intercepted
You were talking about the long, like the Gedon, the ones based on the Shahed. We're talking about drones that attack substations and infrastructure. So we're not talking about the FPV drones on the battle lines, right?
Well, no, I mean, here with like, this is 1,000 drones of various types.
Okay.
So it's not just Shaheds, but there are several thousand Shaheds each month. So, I mean, right. I mean, so that means that Ukrainian army said they took down 1,000 drones of different types. Yeah,
right.
But then there are several thousand Shaheds, just Shaheds,
right,
that are launched. I mean, apparently they got 70% of Shaheds launched at Kyiv in February. Yeah. Obviously, Kyiv is the most prioritized city,
right,
in terms of intercepted drones and other air defense. I mean, there are other issues apart from the just like the supply. They claim to be producing like a huge amount, 30,000 Pisun drones alone each month or whatever, which is kind of possible because these are very basic drones. They cost like $1,000. These are 3D printed, using Chinese components and so on. It's not particularly difficult to make them.
Yeah, you had a really interesting Substack, a newsletter on the Pasoon and the Dilduk and the Yobin, the fucker, and these other drones.
Yeah.
But that, so the Pasoon, which looks like, it almost looks like a, like from a 40s Bugs Bunny cartoon of a rocket bomb or something. But that's an interceptor drone?
Yeah, that's an interceptor drone. And I mean, the Russians also have their own sort of analog, which look fairly similar as well.
Okay.
They're also 3D printed. They got the Yolka, which is like a Christmas tree, a little bit more family friendly. And both sides have these drones. They are, they do work sometimes. It also depends on the weather to a significant extent, like with lots of drones. Another problem that the Ukrainians have been facing is this Russian tactic of flying the Shahed drones very low to the ground, so just 100 meters off the ground or whatever.
Right.
And then it's very difficult for the interceptor drones to detect them, or like to get them essentially.
Right.
And they have to use these mobile groups of basically people with machine guns, which is very dangerous for other people and also just not very effective in any case. And I mean the main really issue, it seems to me, is just the number of drone operators, because it is quite difficult to operate any drone in battlefield conditions. particularly these, because what you're doing is you're chasing down a very quickly moving object, yes. Obviously. The Shaheds, the Russian Shaheds, have also been equipped with a number of evasion tactics, which they automatically perform, or not automatically, depending on the model, when they, you know, detect intercepted drone, which are often successful. And, you know, the Western media is saying that Russia is helping Iran, which is, you know, quite believable. There are also Russian models of these Shahed drones, the Geran in Russia, which is called the Shahed, which are jet-powered, which allows them to travel at speeds of 600, 700 kilometers an hour, which is way out of the range of intercepted drones. Intercepted drones, the Ukrainian ones and the Russian ones, they travel about, you know, 200, 300, at tops 400 kilometers an hour.
So, the jet-powered one is basically a cruise missile at that point, right?
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, and the Iranians also have displayed their own jet-powered model in 2023. I mean, obviously, these are more expensive and so on, but I mean, they do exist. But I mean, beyond all of these sort of, I guess, technical issues, I think the biggest issue is the number of drone operators, because, I mean, it's difficult to do. It's difficult to train people to do this. So, I mean, and when you have like large numbers of drones, which is obviously the whole, you know, tactic with using Shahed drones, you need to have a lot of operators. And then there's the issue of friendly fire, where, you know, they intercept the drones and can hit their own and whatever else. And I mean, so yeah, I mean, Zelensky claimed that 228 have been sent drone operators to the Gulf states. You know, which
those are valuable if they're good at it.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But I mean, like, I guess it's just interesting to see, you know, how they're used, if they're really being used.
Is it just PR, like a PR stunt, pretty much, you think?
I mean, at first it seemed like Zelensky was just sort of saying things that were not being confirmed at all by the by the Americans, by the Gulf states, and it seems like he has sent some kind of drone operators now. There were claims by the Iranians that they hit a drone, you know, warehouse or whatnot in Dubai, which were immediately denied by the Ukrainians. But I mean, it's an interesting event. But yeah, I guess we'll see. But it does seem like this. I mean, there's also lots of interesting potential for sort of, you know, corruption going on as well, because I mean the infamous Firepoint Ukrainian military company, which has been sort of involved in lots of corruption affairs, and it's tied with the infamously sort of corrupt figures in Zelensky's inner circle, Mindich and Yermak. Yeah, I mean, it's very involved with these drones. It's also very involved with the Middle East, because it actually originally showed some of its products at the UAE, and the UAE has done various agreements with it. So, I mean, I mean, with these intercepted drones, there was this thing last week where the head of Rheinmetall, told Simon Schuster at the Atlantic about how these, you know, Ukrainian drones are irrelevant, because not really irrelevant, but I mean that they're made.
He called them Legos, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the Ukrainians got really pissed off,
and so did their European friends. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right. But I mean, like, he does. I mean, you know, he has a point. And I mean, the other point is that these are made using Chinese components, and I'm sure that there are some sort of American security risks with that as well. This has been reported in the Ukrainian press as well, that by, you know, apparently some drone manufacturers say, I mean, well, it's just the Americans don't want our drones because they're Chinese made, which is also possible.
Yes, definitely.
But also, I mean, like, I do feel, obviously, there's this problem with the Western military-industrial complex focusing on, you know, expensive one-off models and so on. But with these drones that Ukraine has, I really do think that the West could easily produce them if they wanted to. They don't really need Ukrainian help in doing so, because these are 3D printed models. I mean, that's my general feeling about it, I think, and definitely a way to try and stay relevant.
I think that's true, because I used to read avidly defense magazines when the United States was producing drones in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and they were really cutting-edge drones. They owned that market. And they decided there's no money in this, and for the officer corps, you're not going to get promoted running a bunch of robots. So they just said, hey, Israel, you want to do this? You can have it. Have all this tech.
Yeah. So can you describe really quickly like how the interceptors work? Because I saw, you may have seen this video. It's pretty, you know, as a rule, the drones have given the most dramatic videos. A lot of them really horrific, ghoulish videos. Very, you know, Philip K. Dick, second variety type of drones chasing around some poor guy who is probably 55 years old and trying to run away from a drone before it goes. But there's been some recent drone interceptor videos, I think coming from the Russians, who, as far as I know from reading you and others, you know, the Russians have really moved well past the Ukrainians in terms of drone technology a couple of years ago. And these interceptors, it was very much like, it was very, again, like kind of sci-fi dystopian. The interceptor, the Russian interceptor, comes upon a Ukrainian, I think it's a reconnaissance drone, and has these like two giant lances, like stingers, like super long stingers. And it comes up and literally punctures the reconnaissance drone and then like scrambles it until the engine sort of catches fire and the whole thing goes falling to the ground. But I imagine a lot of these drones are more like regular drones where you guide your interceptor drone into whatever drone is coming at you or whatever your target is, and then you just blow it up next to it, or do you knock it, or how does it work?
Yeah, I mean, that video was definitely exceptional. I mean, it's not generally how it happens. I think it may have even been what happened in that video was that the drone that attacked, the Russian drone, that was attacking it, was itself a reconnaissance drone, and hence it did not have an explosive, load. I mean, I can't remember exactly, but I mean, I would assume so, because generally, yeah, I mean, intercepted drones, they do have a small explosive payload, and they crash into the target and they blow it up. There's often an element of automatic targeting, but it also it's fairly difficult to properly set it up so that it correctly locks in on the target.
Right.
So I mean, that's essentially how it works. Yeah.
Right, because some of them have, which seems hard to do, but some of them, if I remember, I'd have little gun turrets and fire bullets or shotgun pellets or whatever.
Most of the models that I see, the Ukrainian, Russian ones, they just lock in on the target and they have to catch up with them. So, I mean, this is obviously an issue with this, the speed question. They have to actually be faster than the target they're pursuing. You can see it in videos. They'll fly up into the air and they go behind the target and they have to speed up to catch up with it, and they, slam into it and blow up.
But what you said about the U.S., having security worries about Ukrainian drones because of China. I mean, that's definitely a real thing. It's a great point, because that would also, I would think, be the case for these Gulf countries, because there's a lot of reports, a lot of, I think, pretty reliable sources I've heard as well, that China has also been helping Iran. China definitely does not want to see Iran fall and replaced by, some kind of anti-Chinese, pro-U.S. regime or something. So if you're the Gulf states, and they are extremely paranoid right now, for good reason, but like they're hyper paranoid right now, you would not want Chinese tech, defending you because things could be given away. You're just going to assume that every piece of Chinese tech in something like drone warfare might be detectable by the Chinese and could be passed on. So that really calls into question, what the Ukrainians could really do. I mean, I guess they could give sort of more like tactical advice without actually offering up their tech. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like I suppose like definitely the most relevant idea, which is what Zelensky has done, is sending off these operators. But then the issue is that operators are very valuable in Ukraine itself.
Yes.
I mean, we'll probably talk about it a bit later, but I mean, yeah. The Russian, I mean, both sides sort of claim to be doing this, but it seems like the Russians put a lot more resources into doing this, but this is targeting the opposing drone operators, really making it a priority to destroy the human operators of the drones. Because, you know, you can destroy the drones, but there's millions
yes.
of these drones. But it's the operators that are very valuable.
Does that mean that the two armies are trying to find out where the drone operators work?
Absolutely.
And they're targeting, like with missiles, the centers?
I mean, it can be missiles. It can often also be other drones. The Russian, both sides will often, you know, make statements about having targeted the opposing drone operators. And because the thing is, yeah, I mean, these people take months to train, and it takes a lot of, maybe not months to train themselves, but months to become, good operators, right? And it's interesting as well, because, I mean, in both armies, there's this push to recruit people into the drone squads. And often, I mean, in the Ukraine's army in particular, and in Russia's this phenomenon as well, where, you know, you sort of make the image of the army look a lot more palatable, especially for young people, saying, mm-hmm. look, you know, become a drone operator. You're not going to be an infantry assault team. You're going to be, you know, safe and so on. But, I mean, in reality, these are the most sought for individuals to be destroyed by both sides. And it does happen, quite a lot. So this is the question of sending these operators to the Middle East. These are very much needed in Ukraine itself.
Right.
So I think, you know, this has resulted in, you know, a fair bit of criticism, especially on, you know, social media and so on, by some of the media for Zelensky's decision to do this.
Right. You've written about how it often happens in battle, especially over the last, like, 2 years, how these sort of infiltration groups, I mean, a lot of movement of territory, and we'll get into this a bit later, is really a lot of times is just small groups of infiltrators. And a lot of times these infiltrators aren't really, I mean, they might plant a flag or, you know, do something for the cameras and for social media, but really oftentimes they're just hunting down these the FPV operators and killing them, because often these guys are actually not necessarily defended either. They're supposed to be hidden away somewhere safe. But a lot of times, right, they're just kind of just sitting there, these like gamer dorks, and they just get mowed down or I guess taken POW.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, often in these sort of situations, it's kind of, you know, these are one or two or three infiltrators. They're not really going to take prisoners of war anyway, because, they're like, you know, 7 kilometers behind whatever is the supposed, you know, enemy lines. I mean, it's also hunting down artillery operators. There are, you know, often reports about this. But that definitely happens quite often.
So getting to a breaking story before, I guess this is not at all surprising, but just to break, you know, and by the time anyway this goes up, it will no longer be breaking. But the FT was just running with a big story, the Financial Times, that Trump is threatening the Europeans that he is going to stop supplying weapons to Ukraine, which the Europeans buy under Trump's New America First version of supporting Ukraine, unless the Europeans commit suicide in the Strait of Hormuz for him. He's threatening to basically, and they've been pretty explicit about this, you know, we won't play with your war. We won't, you know, be involved in the war that matters to you if you won't be involved in the war that matters to us. And it says here, three officials familiar with the discussion said Trump responded by threatening to stop supplies to PURL, P-U-R-L. That's NATO's weapons procurement initiative for Ukraine that's funded by the Europeans. And I would assume they would have threatened to withhold intelligence as well. You had an amazing newsletter, maybe we could discuss it right now, about Palantir and what Palantir has been doing in Ukraine, and how this kind of upends the idea also that Ukraine is just purely a Democrat-aligned factional war, because Palantir, of course, is like one of the major backers and kind of ideological backers, in a sense, of Trumpism. Can you talk about what the U.S. is providing, or maybe even just focus on Palantir?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting with the Trump administration. I mean, we know this from this, there was this December 2025 article by the New York Times, and it went into the Trump administration's relationship with Ukraine. And I mean, one of the most interesting things there was that under Trump, the CIA actually massively increased its direct assistance to Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian energy infrastructure, so inside of Russia itself. Right. And I mean, you've seen recently some, you know, quite significant Ukrainian strikes on Russian energy infrastructure as well. Mm-hmm. Last week, there was that attack on the, what's it, Ustlingo, or whatever
yeah,
it's called.
Yeah, Ustlingo in the Baltics area, right?
In the Baltics, that's right, which is apparently, you know, a very significant asset in Russia's, you know, energy exports. And so, I mean, Trump's CIA massively increased their aid for Ukrainians in terms of intelligence assistance and generally, you know, in managing these strikes, which is interesting because, I mean, the Biden administration was actually a little bit possibly more reluctant to get involved with these. Not possibly, like, you know, definitely it was. And Trump, on the one hand, has really cut down the amount of open assistance, let's say, to Ukraine in terms of, you know, direct U.S. military shipments. But then in the CIA side, it's massively increased. And then the American weapons keep on flowing, obviously, through Pearl, but with a 10% markup to make Trump, you know, look look good.
Yeah.
And which I always find really funny as well.
Yeah. You know, it's so, made a little so profit off it. Yeah.
Exactly. And then with Palantir, I mean, Palantir has been working with Ukraine since at least 2022. But I mean, I think it's you know, quite likely that it was earlier. I mean, if you look at the articles as well, they talk about how Ukraine's basically military communications system Delta was created in 2017 with assistance from NATO countries. Mm-hmm. This is from the New York Times. And I mean, you know, it seems quite likely that something, I mean, you know, the line between Palantir and, say, the CIA is very blurred to begin with. But I think it was, you know, in any case. But since 2022, Palantir has been very involved. It's an interesting fact. I mean, Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, he was the first Western businessman at all to visit Zelensky in 2022 after the Russian invasion, which is a, you know. And, you know, they've regularly met. And then the big Palantir sort of protege in Ukraine, who's Mikhailo Fyodorov, he was made the defense minister of Ukraine earlier in 2026. And he's this huge, like, Silicon Valley, not huge, but I mean, he bills himself as this, you know, Silicon Valley tech startup guy, grew up as like sort of USAID, you know, lab kid and so on.
Right.
And he's also, you know, he's really increased cooperation with Palantir this year. So like, it keeps on growing and growing. And I mean, the interesting thing about this cooperation is that Palantir says it's all free for the Ukrainian government. And I mean, you can sort of see why, because they're able to bill their products at, you know, in terms of at military, you know, fairs and whatever, in terms of their advertising, they can really bill that, you know, we've been using this at the battlefield and it's very, very effective, even though there actually have been articles saying that it's not actually that effective sometimes, these Palantir, you know, super products.
What are they doing? What are some Palantir products that are being, I mean, I'm just remembering in my head now these really ghoulish articles that were meant to be like, hey, this is great, in the New York Times and CNN and elsewhere. Ukraine is a laboratory for Western weapons and American weapons. And Zelensky openly saying, hey, test your weapons here with us. What is Palantir doing with them?
I mean, a lot of it is also just with, in terms of data analysis, which I suppose is the overall, you know, the main thing that Palantir does. So in terms of analyzing, you know, the different battlefield strikes on the enemy and the way that the drones work and how successful these types of drones are, how unsuccessful these ones are, and the aim being to improve the the effectiveness of their use.
So targeting.
Targeting, exactly. I mean, there also have been sort of various kind of maybe a little bit silly looking, these kind of huge gadgets. There's some kind of sky kit, some sort of autonomous intelligence center, big box with all of these, AI written on it and stuff. And, with the computer inside and so on, they displayed that at fairs often, and they sort of talk about how the Ukrainian military has been using it, which is, possible. But I think definitely the important thing is, in terms of gathering intelligence, funneling. The whole thing is like with the kill chain, right? I mean, it's like, how fast can you go between identifying a target and then having that target be hit by your side? Because generally this involves a lot of different, intermediaries and communications and so on and so on. And I mean, at least the Western media, and I'm sure this is, I mean, the Russians seem to be taking it very seriously, which is that Ukraine has reduced its kill chain through help from Palantir in terms of also just getting it more accurate intelligence, obviously. Because apparently this was, this Palantir software, Meta Constellation, which is used in Ukraine, apparently. And the Western press was writing about this back in 2022, and apparently it relies on, intelligence from satellites, heat sensors, reconnaissance drones, spies, and so on. But the important thing is that this was apparently used to great effect in late 2022 when the Ukrainians were really targeting Russian logistics, for instance, in the Kherson area, which was, essentially led to the Russians having to retreat from the capital city of Kherson. Mm-hmm. So it does seem like there is some real benefit in it. The Ukrainian government has praised Palantir's work. And there's always a question of how much this is PR, but I'm sure there is some element of truth to it. And as I said before, the Russian sort of military bloggers, they find it very worrying, and they see it as an example, essentially, of how the entire Western ruling classes are behind Ukraine, and Trump is sort of lying, essentially, when he talks about the desire to bring about a peace and so on.
Right. You suggest you hinted at the possibility, maybe that this was just pure speculation, because Palantir's role in the U.S. in ICE and in tracking, and in basically gathering data on and going after undocumented immigrants, migrants. And you sort of speculated whether Palantir is being used at all in, one of the most visibly kind of horrific parts of the Ukraine war effort, which is their forced mobilization effort. I mean, I feel like those videos have gotten, if possible, even worse lately. What do you think? Is there any chance that Palantir might even be helping with that side of things, the mobilization, which is really just forced mobilization for the most part?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite likely, really, because I mean, this is done through. There's this app. What's it called? E-Reserve, I think it's what it's called. But essentially, another one of these apps created by the Palantir guy in Ukraine, Fyodor, who was the Minister of Digital Transformation, now he's the Minister of Defense. And this is basically, so like, when the way it works is when a mobilization officer sees a man on the street, he'll ask for his documents. And that means sort of showing often, your phone and this app for, do you have any reasons to be exempted from the draft and so on? And if not, then they, they pull you into the car. And often, even if you do have reasons, they'll also pull you into the car, which is actually one kind of reason why maybe Palantir is not super necessary here, because it's not really that high tech. It's just essentially, press gangs wandering around looking for men and just grabbing them. Right. And, and their intelligence for doing this is not super high tech. It's just they go to gyms, they go to, workplaces, and they just walk around cities. But I think that, and I think what you say about the intensification of mobilization is absolutely true. And I mean, Ukrainian media has been talking about this as well. It's quite ironic because, I mean, Fyodorov, when he came in, he's, you know, this young, bright face and so on. Mm-hmm. He was talking a lot about how he's going to, there's going to be a huge reform of mobilization. And he even used the word busification, Zelensky did as well, which is the sort of term which previously was called a Russian propaganda term. And it refers to, you know, pulling men off the streets into a bus as they're kicking and screaming, you know, mobilizing them. And so there was this impression that he was giving off that, you know, he was talking about all of the abuses committed during mobilization, this needs to end. But then obviously nothing has happened. And in fact, it seems like the opposite. It seems like it's been, there have been more and more videos as well of mobilization officers even entering apartment blocks and pulling people out of the apartment blocks, and even, you know, entering into the apartment itself, which has really not happened before that much at all. Also, last week, there was a very interesting sort of, I guess you could call it scandal, where a number of about, you know, 30 women in Kharkiv alone and, you know, lots of many women around Ukraine found out that they were actually officially listed as being, that they need to be mobilized and that they're being listed as draft dodgers. These are women, I mean, you know, there are some categories of women that have at least some military obligations, like medics, right?
Well, yeah, I was wondering about that. I was thinking drone operator seems like a really good candidate to recruit a lot of women because, I mean, really, what's the difference in terms of the abilities you'd need to do it?
Because they'd be frontline, I think, and die a lot, right? Or I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like often the thing is the drone operators, they often have to operate quite close to the front lines. So, you know, they're often like sitting in trenches, right? I mean, they almost always are. It's just where the trench is. But often these are trenches that are quite close to enemy troops and, you know, obviously definitely always within fire of enemy drones. And I mean, since most casualties anyway now are largely drones. So, I mean, it's not really that much of a safer option. But I mean, you know, there are some quite mediatized women that are drone operators, and they're always, you know, paraded about on the television and sort of encouraging more women to do this and so on. But I mean, the army has said that this mobilization, this, you know, this issue with women being listed as draftable and as being draft dodgers, this was apparently a mistake. But I mean, you can also sort of see how this could possibly be testing public opinion on this matter. And recently, there have been lots of articles in the Ukrainian sort of like the big Ukrainian liberal press that's owned by, you know, Western figures, talking about how essentially Zelensky has set himself on three more years of war or trying to wait out the Trump administration and wait for a return of the Democrats. So he's going to refuse all of the Trump ceasefire, you know, deals. The main one recently has been basically Ukraine gives up the rest of the Donbas in return for a peace deal, which, I mean, I was actually reflecting on this, and this is actually somewhat interesting because originally the Russians were talking about, you know, four oblasts, right? There was the Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk oblasts that they wanted Ukraine to fully evacuate from. And I mean, that always seemed like a little bit of a, you know, a maximalist negotiation tactic because, I mean, Russia does not control
the majority. It's Zaporozhye and Kherson, isn't it?
That's right. I always get those two. I think I could be, but I mean, in any case, it's the same issue where, I mean, they don't control the main city and so on. But I mean, Russia's no longer talking about those two, and now it's just the Donetsk and Lugansk. And obviously, I mean, Lugansk is all under Russian control.
Right.
And then Donetsk is still a small portion of it that's under Ukrainian control. Anyway, so I mean, it is interesting how the Russian, over the course of the past, say, year, the Russian negotiation position does seem to have changed. But, you know, that's been a different matter. But, I mean, Zelensky is preparing for three more years of war. And, you know, for that, they need to mobilize more people and so on and so on.
I think Putin, at least it was reported, he said that he's giving either now or what he's giving Zelensky and the Ukrainians 2 months to abandon Donbas, or else the terms will get even worse, which I mean, is the reason I asked, because I would assume, based on what he's done in the past, that would mean he's going to announce the annexation of Dnipropetrovsk and, let's say, Kharkov Oblast. Mm. That's usually what it means. If you don't agree now, we're going to add another oblast.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's possible. Because, I mean, the reason I always confuse the Kherson with Dnipropetrovsk Oblast is because, I mean, really, like, lots of the fighting the past year or so has been taking place in the Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, in the sort of easternmost reaches of it. But this was, you know, quite an important development over the course of 2025. And it has always seemed like, I mean, this is a very important strategic target for them as well. And in case, I mean, like, taking that would really, that's really, you know, this a scenario in which Russia has control of the left bank, Ukraine, of the Dnieper, and just like the strategic importance of the city of Dnipropetrovsk as this huge, you know, million person city with, you know, massive industrial assets, and the political importance of this city as well in Ukrainian national consciousness and Ukrainian politics and so on.
And Soviet politics. You've done some great newsletters on it. Yeah. On the importance of Dnipropetrovsk, or which is now Dnipro, but I actually would like to get into a sit rep. Have you, you know, the sit rep on where the war is right now. But before we do that, before we leave the drone story, what do you know about how Ukraine has been hitting these Russian refineries and taking, I mean, Reuters claimed they're taking 40% of Russian oil off the market. And, you know, you would think that somebody would tell them not to because of what's going on with oil prices being high and restricted and Trump actually trying to give waivers to Russian oil in order to bring the prices down. Like, I guess I was just wondering, is Zelensky doing that? Is it just like opportunity, you know, the opportunity arose and so he did it, and especially because the Ukrainians wouldn't be happy that the Russian revenues will go up again because of their ability to sell oil? Or would the Europeans at all be sort of aligned with them on this, or even the Americans? Maybe the Americans, like, you know, as you pointed out, the CIA has been much more involved. So it's like, on the one hand, Trump publicly shows what a great friend he is to Russia or whatever, you know, by allowing them to sell more oil, but quietly the CIA helps them bomb a bunch of refineries so that they actually can't sell as much as they'd want to. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think, I mean, originally as well, Zelensky, I mean, not originally, this is increasingly so. I mean, Zelensky has been saying that his intercepted drone assistance to the Gulf is in exchange for, you know, Gulf assistance to Ukraine in terms of diesel fuel, because Ukraine has been dealing with some very serious, or is about to deal, at least according to Reuters and so on, with some very serious diesel fuel shortages, which are obviously very important for the army and for the entire country. So the idea is that Saudi Arabia is going to, you know, apparently give them a discount of diesel fuel, although it's not really entirely clear if that's true, but that's what Zelensky claims. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, targeting these assets is definitely an interesting move. I sort of assume it's a not sort of opportunistic move, although it does seem like there was some sort of, you know, it seems like it was a fairly serious operation. And it does seem, I mean, you know, there's lots of conflicting reports about this. And I don't really have a particularly strong opinion, but it seems fairly likely that the Europeans used their airspace.
That's what I think. Yeah, but there's a lot of fighting going on, and the usual nastiness about if somebody suggests they're flying over, you know, EU airspace, you don't know what you're talking about. You're, you know, the Michael Kaufmans and stuff stepping in to bring the adults in the room. But like, how many more Ukrainian drones can crash in EU space before you say, okay, they're using NATO airspace for these attacks?
Yeah, I mean, it also seems, I mean, it seems sort of like a bit of a cop-out, because, I mean, you know, they've already said multiple times, you know, so this New York Times article and so on, that, you know, the Americans are directly helping them in their drone strikes on Russia. So why would it really matter that much if they're flying through Lithuania and so right. on. I mean, in terms of, you know, I don't know. I think there was the statements from the Baltic governments, but they've been sort of saying how, you know, they haven't been flying through us, but even if they did, it wouldn't matter, sort of this yeah. of this type. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I sort of struggle to find a strong, you know, I think it is contradictory. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, obviously the idea is that, yeah, I mean, Zelensky was saying how Russia earned, you know, $10 billion of extra revenue in the first week or 2 weeks of mm-hmm. this Iran war. And the idea is that, honestly, I often find it a little bit difficult to get particularly enthusiastic about covering this energy strike campaign from both sides, right? Because, I mean, I don't know, if you look at the history of wars, no war has ever been won by, you know, bombing the other side's infrastructure. And, I mean, in the past, there have been much larger cases of this, you know, obviously like World War II and mm-hmm. so on. And they didn't lead to victory, right? Well, obviously, you can talk about Vietnam and whatever mm-hmm. else, and you know that was totally different, you know, like just mass carpet bombing of the opposing, you know, civilian infrastructure. And here, I mean, like, you know, they strike some, you know, these assets, and on both sides, this is true when the Russians strike the Ukrainian energy assets, you know, and they eventually repair them, mm-hmm. they get them back running, and obviously. It leads to some problems, but I mean, I think that there are lots of people on both sides that have some kind of hope that this will lead mm-hmm. to the, you know, this grand collapse of the opposing side, and it never happens. I mean, I've watched this so many winters now with Ukraine, yeah. and each time, you know, the Russians and, you know, people will say like, oh, you know, this winter Ukraine will collapse, and then there'll be people saying this in Ukraine as well, you know, like, oh, this winter the energy system will collapse, and you know, it's terrible for ordinary people, but you know, the country manages to get through it, and the army manages to get the supplies it needs, and so on.
Yeah.
Does the energy supply ever actually run out in winter? Like, buildings don't have any more ability to heat their apartments?
There were
it
moments.
It absolutely does. I mean, yeah. This past winter, it was really terrible. I mean, there were you know, lots of. There were millions of people that had no energy for days, and for some people even for weeks, particularly in Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporozhye, closer to the front lines. But I mean, also, this was, I mean, in fact, they seemed to do a little bit better in terms of the energy than Kiev. There were lots of political sort of arguments blaming the mayor, Klitschko, and whatever else. But I mean, the fact is that lots of people, they had no electricity, and this led to all kinds of terrible things where, like, you know, for instance, the sewage system just broke, and people's, you know, apartments were like flooded with shit and all this kind of thing, and then it would freeze and all kinds of crazy
right.
situations
burst,
like that.
Right?
Yeah. Pipes burst, exactly, yeah. and just generally, you know, it was a very cold winter. It was a much colder winter than previous, and it was really terrible. You know, that there's just countless cases of, you know, where you have old pensioners and so on that are just dying in their apartments, and you know, obviously, no one really this doesn't really matter, say, to anyone, but it's a real human tragedy, really. Yeah.
Right.
So let's bring it back to where we are in the war. I mean, again, you know, the fourth anniversary of the war passed up. This was, you know, the biggest, most important war in decades
ever.
For the West, or if not ever, yeah. And the fourth year anniversary just passed and went with a whimper. But of course, you know, it hasn't, I mean, as many people are dying, the war hasn't gone away whatsoever. There were kind of two themes or two narratives that were coming out from the kind of pro-Ukraine war cause side. One was that Russia's revenues were, that the economic war on Russia, now we hear this every few months, but like they were really ramping it up again, that Russia's revenues were really dire, and that the economy really was, this time really was, on the verge of some kind of crisis before, you know, before oil shot up. And the second one was that Ukraine had conducted some kind of amazing counteroffensive that took, you know, huge swaths of land, particularly in the south, and that Russia's whole sort of military machine had otherwise kind of ground to a halt. So what's the truth there?
Yes, I mean, obviously, in terms of the financial stuff, it's pretty hard to take seriously, especially now. But in general, I mean, the Russian financial situation was never really that bad. I mean, you know, they had a budget deficit of 2% of the GDP. And, you know, if you look at Ukraine, it's huge. It's like 18-19%. And Ukraine obviously depends on this foreign aid and so on, whatever. I mean, I think it's not really that worth talking about so much. But, I mean, with the military situation, so, I mean, I guess, like, the grain, I mean, there are two grains of truth here. And the first one is that, so, I mean, 2025 was the best year for the Russian army since the start of the war. And they took back, a huge amount of territory. This is especially in the south. So this is the Zaporozhye Oblast and, to an extent, the Dnipropetrovsk Oblast. And then over the course of the first 3 months of 2025, the Russian advance slowed down significantly. And obviously, it's always difficult how you count that and so on. But there definitely has been some kind of slowdown. And, I mean, there are different ways to explain this. And, I mean, I think one of the problems that emerges is that when you try and measure what's going on, for instance, the Ukrainian army and OSINT and so on, they often refer to the number of Russian assault operations. And they say, well, look, this hasn't decreased. So this means that the Russians are still trying just as much as before, but they're failing. But then the issue is that often these assault operations will just be a tiny group of infantry, walking up to a Ukrainian position, trying to get it, maybe getting killed, retreating or whatever else. Often, two or three people. But then there's the tracker of losses, which is Oryx, exists online.
Right.
Oryx.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And it's quite a pro-Ukrainian.
Very much,
I believe so. But. What's interesting is that over the past 3 months, it actually shows a huge decrease in the amount of Russian armored losses that's taking place. So it shows 50 armored losses a month, whereas before in December, say 2025, it was 150 and so on. So basically, this lends credence to the idea that. The Russian forces have been regrouping over the past 3 months. They actually haven't really been engaged in massive assault operations. Obviously, people will say, they have no tanks left. And I think that's just not true. But it is true that both sides are just using less armor in general because of the threats posed by drones. But I think when you look at that big difference, I think there is something there. And what you really saw last year is that at the end of December 2025, Russia accomplished a couple of pretty important goals in the battlefield, mainly the taking of Pokrovsk in the Donetsk Oblast, and then in the Zaporozhye Oblast, the taking of Gulaipolye. And both of these towns put it in a fairly improved strategic position in both places, and then the task was to consolidate its position here. And then apart from that, you also have the fact that the weather this winter has been particularly bad compared to previous winters. And this results, it also has an impact on drones, where lots of drones, their batteries actually won't work in these very cold temperatures. They actually can't take off. And this is true for both sides. But in any case, it makes offenses more difficult. Also, when you have fog, which also makes it difficult for drone operators and so on. And then possibly the most important weather-related factor is the fact that in the winter months, there's no vegetation, which is used by Russian infantry and Ukrainian infantry during assault operations to hide from enemy drones. And this is set to return in April, May, and Ukrainian military telegrams have been saying at this time it's definitely certain to expect an increase in Russian offensive operations. So that's one thing. But Russian offensive operations have continued, and particularly in the Donbas, which is apparently, the main, according to all these different Western media and Zelensky and Russian government as well, this is the main theater of the war in terms of, mm-hmm. You know, including it and whatever else. But I mean, yeah, so the Russians haven't advanced. They have advanced here fairly consistently all throughout the Donbas front over the past 3 months, just like before. But it is in the south, in the southern part of the front line, that there have been quite large Ukrainian counterattacks, particularly in January and February. And then by March, they've really slowed down, and Russians have sent reinforcements and it's really slowed down. But it's interesting, look, and this is the basis of the claims of Ukraine sort of turning the tides of war. So when you see these Western media reports that, you know, Ukraine's winning again, they're talking about the south because you know, no one's reporting gains in the Donbass. It's obviously mm-hmm. the opposite. But in the south, there's, you know, to begin with, there's very seriously conflicting numbers where Zelensky and his chief of staff, Syrsky, they talked about over 400 square kilometers retaken by the Ukrainians in 2026 in the south. And then if you look at like Deep State, which is the main Ukrainian sort of OSINT mm-hmm. military mapping resource, which is, it works with the army and it has definitely, you know, some pro-Ukrainian bias, but it is more critical than obviously Zelensky and head of the army. Right. And they were talking, they said that they think it's only 75 square kilometers that were retaken. Mm-hmm. And they were talking, and you can look at like Ukrainian military journalists, they say that essentially, I mean, what happened is that the reason Zelensky has such huge figures is because it's really a question of definitions of what you count to begin with as actually controlled by Russia to begin with, and on the other hand, as what you count as being controlled by Ukraine on the other hand. Because, I mean, the way that fighting in the south takes place, it's a little bit different from the Donbas, because in the Donbas, it's very urbanized territory, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when they take a town, it's quite, they have to put a lot of people in there and to hold on to the town and so on. But in the Zaporozhye, these villages that we're talking about, they had like pre-war populations of like 15 people, right? These mm-hmm. are really, really tiny locations. And many of these places have no citizens at all, no residents at all, and probably even before the war might have had no residents. So this means that the fighting here is a lot more sort of fluid and dynamic than elsewhere, where you'll have, you know, Russian infantry that can make quite large sort of movements forward. And it's such a huge expanse, this huge step, that the Ukrainians just don't have enough manpower to cover it up, and they can get through. But this means that, you know, they were sort of counting as controlled by Russia villages that just had maybe a couple of Russian infantry in them, or maybe even they weren't in there to begin with. They just went in there at one point and left and whatever else. But so that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is as well is that in order to accomplish these counterattacks, you know, there have been territory that has been, at least to some extent, retaken by Ukraine. Although, again, I mean, like on Deep State, they only really show, they don't show any like increase in consolidated Ukrainian territory. They just show an increase in contested area. That's what they show over the past 3 months. They don't show any increase in consolidated. It's just an increase in contested area. In some parts, maybe the contested area has reduced. But anyway, but in order to accomplish this, this has been accomplished by these Ukrainian assault units, which have been mm-hmm. moved down into this area, particularly the 225th Assault Regiment, also the 425th Assault Regiment. And they've been the ones that have been really retaking this territory. And, I mean, these assault regiments are extremely notorious in the Ukrainian army. They report directly to Syrsky. They don't report
the commander
to
in chief.
The commander in chief, and they don't. You know, other units they report to the commander of the corps. And this was actually meant to be this big reform that was meant to improve Ukraine's military coordination and also the responsibility of commanders. That would actually, the idea was that they would stop sort of like sending their troops on pointless suicide missions because they would have the same troops always. They would be more responsible for these troops because they would be always under their responsibility, right? But then these assault units, it's totally different. They don't have a corps commander. They just have a single commander who reports directly to Syrsky. And Syrsky tells them, you need to go and, you know, stop the Russian advance or, you know, create a Ukrainian victory in this territory, and they accomplished that. They were actually originally formed in the Kursk operation of 2024. Mm. And these were the units that were essentially, they were the most loyal to Syrsky. They were willing to conduct this operation that many Ukrainian commanders thought was a terrible idea and were removed as a result. But these assault units were totally happy to. Anyway, I mean, these assault units are just, the Ukrainian media is constantly talking about them, at least like the sort of Western-funded kind of oppositional media, because of the huge losses that these assault units entail among their own men. I mean, there were also reports in December 2025, that this assault unit, the 225th, that it had actually killed other Ukrainian soldiers from the local units that were not assault units that had tried to desert. So essentially, you know, fulfilling the role of a blocking detachment. The army claimed this was a misunderstanding, but then there were other, there have been lots of sort of misunderstandings with these assault units. I mean, there was also this ongoing case where the assault unit around this, also in the south, they just abducted dozens of soldiers from a nearby Ukrainian unit from the 108th Territorial Defense Brigade. They abducted them, took away their weapons, put them in a basement, gave them like a bottle to piss in and so on, and then just sent them to the front line. But now through the assault unit, you know, a number of them have died very quickly.
Wow.
Or have gone missing.
Real quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but about that, it's because these assault brigades themselves are sent on so many suicidal missions, so they went and kidnapped people from other units and forced them to do the most dangerous suicidal jobs that they were getting assigned, and basically turned them into like their own kind of suicide slaves or something. I mean,
They just suffer from serious losses. They always need more troops. I mean, the assault units, this is officially they have priority for new recruits. So most of the people getting mobilized often now, they're getting sent to these assault units. And they have a massive reputation now in Ukraine. They've increased by 10 times just over the past 10 years, these assault units. And what's kind of crazy about them as well is that they're only regiments. So, I mean, technically. But in fact, they're much larger than regiments. They're the size of a division at this point. Mm. They have 15 battalions just in the 225th. Wow. Assault regiment, which is the size of three brigades or one division.
Right.
So, which also means they have far too few, people to deal with different, maybe the health issues and other issues of their subordinates. There was a case yesterday of a number of fighters in the newly mobilized troops in the 425th assault regiment that died of pneumonia. And this was because they were refused treatment, and they just died. One of them in an ambulance on the way to the hospital, and so on. Apparently, they all had pneumonia. But I mean, so this is there've been lots of announcements recently. There was one recently that the International Volunteer Brigade or whatever it
the
was
International
called,
Legion, yeah.
That's right. It had been dismantled. It suffered
right.
various issues. But I mean, what was really notable was that it's the people in that brigade getting sent now to the assault units. And this has also been true of people, because this is also the reason why there's such high desertion. It's because often it's an issue where people really want to transfer out of their brigade into another one that they hope will be better.
Right.
And they can't do that. It's not possible to do that. So they just desert. And there have been lots of initiatives to try and reduce the level of desertion by giving people the option of, at least in theory, of moving to a different brigade that's better, that they can choose. But then in reality, what's happened is that people were given the option to return to the army, but they still don't have really the option to choose which unit they go to. And that the priority is always to the assault units.
Are most deserters caught? And if so, what is their punishment? Are any of them executed? Because that tends to happen when desertion is a real problem in armies. Like, they come up with more and more hideous punishments.
formally, like legally, there's really no punishment of desertion. There have been like a small handful of attempts to prosecute deserters, but it's just that the scale is so huge. I mean, just in 2025, there were about 200,000 cases of AWOL or desertion. So wow. It's just not possible to deal with that in that sense.
200,000 AWOL in 2025 alone. That's just insane. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and it was because they actually made the statistics secret after this, right. After it was like November or December, because it was not looking very, very nice in the news. But there was a really interesting interview yesterday by Ukraine's like Radio Free Europe branch with the military ombudsman. So he deals with all kinds of like military human rights and all this kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was asked about the level of desertion, and he said that it's the same as in 2025, which is 20,000 people deserting a month. And in terms of if they're caught, I mean, they generally aren't caught. Sometimes they'll be mobilized again, but generally they just hide. There are lots of cases of sort of deserters that, you know, they maybe, last week there was one of, you know, they killed two people, they were drunk and whatever else. I mean, obviously, you know, they're hiding and they have weapons and they're sort of fugitives, right? But some of them do return, but there are no statistics about how many of them return. And it's definitely not, say, the majority of them.
I mean, I remember seeing one of these sort of longtime pro, these like intrepid bearded journalists who are actually like, you know, pro whatever NATO's for at the time. He came back to Kyiv for the first time in a while. He was posting about how kind of he was trying to be delicate about it because he knew how people are online, but just kind of how shocked he was at how so many males are hiding. There's like an Anne Frank in everybody's attic right now, but it's basically a draft age male hiding out, and it's really serious. Do you still read about, is it like that? Like where they just hide for days, weeks, months on end? I mean, they must be terrified to go out because they could just be nabbed.
I mean, I know people like that, you know. It's like it's years, right? It's terrible, and it's really awful for your, you know, your relationships with your family, say with your wife or, and so on. It's awful because, you know, you can't work and you have no income,
right?
And because, you know, people know that they're going to be sent to the assault units. Another thing I forgot to mention about them is that they lead in terms of the complaints, in terms of beating, extortion and torture of the subordinates, you know. I mean, this is also widespread throughout the army. But it's like, you know, there's often like corruption where like the commander wants you to like, you know, build his stupid, you know, his house and whatnot, right. Or just to give you money from your salary. And if you refuse, then you're put into a hole and, you know, like crucified and so on. And crucified, right. Like literally, there was a photo of this.
Yeah, I remember that.
Wow. But I mean, like, so it's a big sort of corrupt machine that is also involves, you know, also obviously constantly the threat of death and of dying and so on. So
yeah,
people don't want to do that for whatever reason.
there was a recent battle, and I think you said this did involve an assault brigade. This is in Hryshchina, which is sort of northwest of Pokrovsk in the Donetsk oblast. And I saw Ukrainians in particular, some pro-Russians, but particularly pro-Ukrainians, angrily talking about it because whoever, I guess it's Sirsky, who is known as the butcher for butchering his own troops instead of butchering the other guy's troops. But they sent them on a mechanized assault on a Russian position. And it sounds like a large numbers of sort of armor were taken out. I was almost surprised to see armor used, especially in winter when there, as you said, there's no cover. So it sounds like they got decimated from the angry reaction from the Ukraine crowd. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, I mean, I saw that. That was posted in particular by Sergei Stranenko, who's like this big nationalist blogger, essentially, and like the biggest Ukrainian YouTuber. He's also an aide to the minister.
Right.
I mean, yeah, he's a very, 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 very unpleasant individual. But yes. that's a different matter.
It's enough of them, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Try not to think about that too much. You know? it's all fucked up enough. But anyway, but I mean, he's also an aide to the Minister of Defense, a few other Palantir guy as of this year. it is. So he was did this thing about how, like, you know, the assault brigade, the assault units, you know, like doing suicide missions, which is, you know, true. But I think there is also this element. I mean, I've sort of been thinking about this, where Stranenka and similar sort of like liberal nationalist kind of NGO type, but also extremely nationalist people, they've really made the assault units into this, like, I wouldn't say a scapegoat, because they definitely are terrible and they definitely have been growing massively. But it's also, I mean, like, this is not, they're not really unique for the Ukrainian army. It's just, mm-hmm. it is, they, you know, they're worse than, say, some units, but this is also things that are observable in the rest of the army as well. And this is also part of, like, Stanyenko, like, they're always raging about Sirski, and, you know, and Sirski definitely, sure, but also, I mean, he's doing what Zelensky tells him to do as well. I mean, it's not like, you know, Sirski is this mad genius that's sort of destroying the army, which is often how he's kind of portrayed by, say, Stanyenko and stuff. I mean, Zelensky tells Sirski, you need to make some victories that can show the Western media, show that yes. we're not losing. And yeah. you need to, you know, try and stop the Russians, however, as long as possible, even if strategically, with just it's going to result in a lot of losses and really not much difference in the long term. But I mean, you know, that's what he's told, and that's what he does. And he might be more competent at doing that than maybe, you know, someone that Stranenko, yes. like, you know, obviously than Stranenko, who's just like an idiot on YouTube. But I mean, yeah. like, generally. So I mean, I think there's an element of that. But I mean, with this Pokrovska, I mean, yeah, the assault units have been used a lot. Since December in these claimed, you know, incursions into Pokrovsk, which are often just suicide missions where they just go into Pokrovsk, which is held by the Russians, and they plant a flag and they kill people. And can, you know, there was a case, I remember, in December where there were people were talking about, you know, dozens of Ukrainian troops that were killed just in this right. one flag raising operation. So I mean, this is, you know, and I think this was, I'm pretty sure this was the 225th assault regiment. It might have been another one, but so this is definitely happening for sure.
Right. So just a quick drone warfare question. When we last had you on talking about drones, I think you said that the sort of the line of fire for first-person drones and just drone warfare in general, like the sort of no man's land had grown from like 10 kilometers behind lines to 15 or 20 kilometers. I mean, is it, I don't know, has that changed much, or maybe even more at some point? Has that changed much, or is that still roughly where it was sort of last year?
Yeah, it is somewhere around that. It also depends on, you know, which part of the front line. You know, you have some parts with more effective drone units and some with less effective ones, more drones, less drones. But there was also this case earlier this year of the Americans cutting Starlink access to the Russians. But this seemed to really be more of an issue for Russians sort of like, say, like medium, long-range attacks, like in, like, to say, like, 50-kilometer range when the Russians would use Starlink to increase the distance of the drones.
Right.
But these still continue just through other means, through like retranslators, which like extend, and all kinds of other means. And the Russians are trying to, last week, they actually, they launched their own sort of satellite, which they've been talking about for about a year, which was greeted with some, enthusiasm by, you know, Russian military telegrams. But then, I mean, the one thing that I did want to talk about, which is a pretty interesting broader trend on the front line about this drone warfare, is that Ukraine had this big thing last year. They announced this drone line. I mean, they have all these different terms, these kind of like very like, advertising sort of thing. They had the drone line. So it was like the kill zone and what was it? Or the line of drones and, and whatever else. But basically, the idea was is that, you know, we're going to make it this sort of defensive stance of turning this large strip of the front line of like, you know, 10-kilometer, 15-kilometer width.
A drone wall, right? I think like a drone wall.
Drone wall, that's right. They had lots of different terms for it. It was meant to be this huge, big, like strategic new thing. And it was, you know, which will make Russian advances impossible because they all got killed by drones, right? And since then, especially with the appearance of Fyodorov as defense minister, the Ukrainian government has really been going really hard the past few months of saying, we're going to defeat Russia by killing, you know, 50,000 Russian troops a month, right? Yes. And this is going to be more than they can, this is going to be more than they recruit, and the army will just collapse, right? And I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of this approach, you know, by some Ukrainian military people, particularly those closer with Azov as well. They think it's like strategically pointless because, I mean, to begin with, there's also doubts of these numbers that are being thrown about. Often, there's the issue as well that these numbers can often be based on two drones from two different units hitting the same guy, but counting it as two people and whatever else. And then, like, you know, also how you count injured as opposed to killed. And there are lots of issues with these numbers. But the broader issue beyond that is that the drone line has not really worked out in practice because the way it was built, and this would have been, say, effective, is that it was going to actually penetrate 10 kilometers, right? 15 kilometers into it's not really a Russian side or Ukrainian side. It's very chaotic at this point. But basically create a 15-kilometer strip, gray zone, right? But then the issue is that in fact, all that it's Ukrainian drone dominance really only exists for about 3 kilometers, on a 3 kilometer strip. It's something that Ryan O'Leary often talks about. Mm-hmm. He's this American, some kind of American military big shot sort of guy, but he's been fighting in Ukraine for years now. I think he's still there, I'm pretty sure. He's had a lot of criticism of the Ukrainian military command. And in particular, he's been very frustrated the past couple months about this whole drone discourse. We're going to defeat Russia by killing 50,000. And he really points out that the issue is that the Ukrainians, their drones are only focusing on the Russian infantry that are essentially entering into Ukrainian positions. They don't have enough drones and they have so many targets to focus on, which means that they're not creating this big wall. They're just sort of trying to pick off the people that are entering into the Ukrainian positions. And this is why Ukraine is still, you know, losing territory constantly.
So they're not getting like logistics and people move the way the Russians are, because the Russians use, as I understand, use drones and artillery and like FAB, KAB bombs for, delivered from aircraft to really soften up or interdict all the logistics behind the lines.
Yeah, it's something that Ryan O'Leary really talks about a lot. I mean, like all of Ukrainian military people talk about, which is that Russia has really made its priority logistics. Mm-hmm. And then whereas Ukraine, it has this point system, which basically allocates discounted drones to units who get more points. And they prove the points through videos of, you know, destroyed Russian objects. But the problem is that this point system, it gives quite a lot of priority to killing infantry. And this looks, in their opinion, at least, it looks very good as a video. So they'll always be posting these videos of, like, you know, killing Russian troops and whatever else. But the thing is that in the strategic view of things, it really doesn't matter, right? Because, you know, there are lots of people signing up in the Russian army as contract soldiers. And the logistics remain very strong, whereas the Russian army doesn't have this point system, and they really just focus on destroying Ukrainian logistics quite far from the front line, 20, 30, even 50 kilometers away, hitting these roads, hitting Ukrainian cars as well that are carrying supplies, which is really important, also hitting drone operators. And when you look at Ukrainian media, and they always say this, and Ukrainian military people, is that the Ukrainians really have nothing of the order that is the Russian Rubicon drone team, which developed in 2024 and has been sort of growing in importance and size since. And Russian Rubicon drone team, it involves research and technology and testing and also obviously, you know, using it at the front lines and also training other Russian units. It also just means, just in general, the Russian army has much more drones than the Ukrainian army does.
And more advanced, right? Yeah.
I mean, often more advanced.
Well, they invented the fiber optic, as far as I know, at least were the first to deploy the fiber optic drones, which are, you're starting to see those in Lebanon.
And this is also a question of just like, properly deploying technologies, because, you can have all these kind of interesting ideas, but unless you actually find a way of testing them at the battlefield and then scaling this up and producing a large number of them, and this is what the Russians have been really good at. And then the Ukrainians, on the contrast, they have a very sort of like decentralized drone market. Mm-hmm. And even like Michael Kaufman and these kinds of like, War on the Rocks guys, they've been criticizing this as well.
Yeah.
The way that the Ukrainian drone market works is just like, dozens of these different independent producers and they have like just essentially just connections with the government, and they get huge funding. But they're also competing with each other. It ends up meaning that often they're just producing quite similar versions of the same thing, but receiving a huge amount of funding for it. And then also just models that are just not really that applicable, not that useful. Whereas the Russians have this different approach of essentially a very small number, like two or three drone manufacturers and so on, that really just focus on improving the same model, using battlefield experience, improving it further, and which is much more effective, essentially.
God, I have to just say here, I don't mean to make a Nazi analogy here, but we've been doing this series on Operation Barbarossa with Anibale, and this really mirrors, like, where the Nazis had 50 different types of tanks and armored personnel carriers and infantry vehicles, armored vehicles, and with everything, they had all kinds. And then part of that was because they would take over a country like Czechoslovakia, which actually produced great armor and vehicles. But part of it was also because of their system, which was basically like a private capitalist system, with this sort of Nazi layer on top. And so you had all these very corrupt industrial plutocrats all like trying to design and compete with each other for making just redundant, armaments. Whereas the Soviets had everything very streamlined. The Soviet way, which is a more, functional state, just works so much better, of course, in the end. And I think, ultimately this is a story of the two political systems and the really failed the Ukraine political system. Yesterday, the day before, the AP just did this big reported story on how much the Russian state is investing into occupied Ukraine. And then it was run, I think, in conjunction with NPR. I thought it was BBC, but it might have been NPR. And the story, it was a very strange story, because the idea was sort of like, look at how evil Russia is for building up these areas that it's taken. It means they plan to keep it. It means they're also like siphoning off some of the wealth, but they're obviously investing wealth too. I mean, it's very different from the Gaza approach, put it that way. But I guess what I'm wondering is, are you able to glean how Ukrainians who are living in occupied Ukraine, like how they are experiencing it? Because you don't, like, there's been no real insurgency that, I have to admit, that was one of the things I did expect early on. And there were signs very early on, but there hasn't been. And I get the sense, too, that a lot of Ukrainians on civilians living within, however many kilometers of the front line. I mean, it depends where you are, but a lot of them are not necessarily so against being taken over by Russia and becoming part of like Novorossiya or whatever they're going to call it. Are you able to get a sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting, statistics is there have been a number of statements over the past year, 2 years by Ukrainian government, government figures, parliamentarians as well, about the number of internally displaced people returning to the Donbas from western central Ukraine. Right? And I mean, this is also often just because of the lack of economic opportunities, where you know, IDPs in Ukraine, they get about 2,000 hryvnia a month, which is nothing. It's like $50 or so US dollars. So okay. it's really it's like the same level as a lot of pensions. Most pensions mm-hmm. are about that level, and so that's totally useless. And then there's high rents. Rents have been increasing because there's more and more internally displaced people in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Rents, especially in Western Ukraine, and in Kyiv as well, they've remained stable, which is pretty incredible considering the constant missile strikes and so on. But because mm-hmm. of the number of displaced people, so lots of people return for that reason. There's no jobs to be found in Ukraine and so on. I think a lot of it is really to do with this aspect of it, and there's also the other there's also the aspect which is that the Russian authorities in Donbass and so on, basically, if you're not there to that, then your house will get taken by someone else, and this is in Crimea as well, and you need to sort of go to a court essentially in Russia or in these territories to make sure your house remains yours, which mm-hmm. is another reason why people go back there for that reason. There are these aspects to it. I mean, in terms of the reconstruction, I think it's also difficult where lots of these territories are still close to the front lines. So it's quite difficult to do that. I think with Mariupol, it's been easier because it's very far from mm-hmm. the front lines at this point. But a lot of the other territories that have been sort of more recently taken by the Russians are still very close. So there's that aspect. But yeah, I mean, like, there was an interesting post recently by Bezugla, this parliamentarian, basically mm-hmm. she in Ukraine. And she just basically said, well, the Russians in 2022, they decided to focus on the Donbass instead of Kyiv because they knew that the civilians in the Donbass would be more supportive than in the Kyiv region, say. So this is a factor, and it's a factor when Russian infantry, they'll infiltrate a Donbass city, and sometimes maybe they'll be in sort of like civilian looking style clothing, and they can be maybe supported by local civilians. This happens, and this leads to lots of sort of anger by Ukrainian troops, calls for total sort of evacuation of these cities. So this does exist. But I think a lot of people are just really quite they are very worried about their own safety mm-hmm. and their economic opportunities. And I think for most people, it's not really ideological decisions so much being
that
made
makes
here.
Sense.
For some people, sure. But I mean, a lot of these economic issues that I was mentioning before,
Right. No, that makes sense. Okay, I think we've had a great discussion. I really appreciate it. And I always want to get you back on again. But I cannot emphasize enough to our listeners to subscribe to Peter's excellent Substack, Events in Ukraine. It's great. It's very in-depth, detailed. You get the Ukraine, as Ukrainians themselves report and talk about and live and experience Ukraine, wartime Ukraine, rather than that sort of glossy filter that that the Western press puts on it. It's very unvarnished. It's very brutal. It's funny at times. Anyway, I really appreciate it, Peter, coming on Radio War Nerd again. And thanks, everybody. Thanks to Brendan, John, Peter, and all of our subscribers. And talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay.